Hello, this is Hugh Baird. I'm your moderator for this evening's discussion. I'm here with State Senator Art Haywood and his guests. We want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guests at any time this evening, press star 3 on your phone's keypad. And now I'd like to welcome Senator Art Haywood.
Thank you, you, and thank you to all of the area residents participating on tonight's call. Some of the best feedback and ideas that I have received come directly from these calls. I'm State Senator Art Haywood, and I'm holding this live telephone town hall where we will be joined by my special guest, firearms attorney Jonathan Goldstein. We will discuss responsible gun ownership and answer questions you may have. This format will allow you to listen in and even ask a question from the comfort of your home. If you'd like to ask a question at any time, press star 3 on your phone. Now, I had an early conversation with Jonathan at a class that he taught, and it was clear to me he said two things that I thought we needed to share. First, often on guns and gun ownership, we talk past each other. That's not what we want to do this evening. Second, Jonathan has and I have a high level of civility. Even if there's disagreement, we've got to be able to maintain civil discourse because in the end, we all share Pennsylvania. Having said that, I want to introduce Jonathan so he can share who he is and some ideas, some overview, I understand, of gun laws in Pennsylvania. Jonathan.
Senator, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be with you this evening and with your constituents. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what we know about firearms death today and just tee up some statistics that will maybe give us a basis for a conversation. And then go from there, go right to the questions. I find often the best learning comes from listening to what folks have to say about this and ask some questions, and let's see what we can learn from them. So let me begin by just laying out a few facts. So gun deaths today are actually at an all-time low. The number of privately owned guns in the United States is at an all-time high. More than 300 million firearms are privately owned in the United States today. Over the last 20 years, 132 million new guns were added to the U.S. population. And yet the firearms accident death rate has fallen to an all-time low of 0.2 per 100,000 people. This is down 94% since the all-time high in 1904. Since 1930, the annual number of firearms accidents deaths has decreased 81% at a time when the U.S. population has more than doubled, and the number of firearms is up fivefold. The homicide rate in 2014 was 4.5 per 100,000, which is the lowest recorded since 1963. And firearms-related homicides are down almost 40% from 1993 to 2011, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is part of the DOJ. Now, that is not the experience that everyone in the United States is having with firearms. What we know is that a small fraction of all counties in the United States are responsible for the majority of murders that happen in the U.S. How small a fraction? Well, 54% of all U.S. counties in 2014 had zero murders. 2% of counties have 51% of the murders. 37% of the murders in the United States in 2014 occurred in 1% of the counties. So what does this tell us? What it tells us is murder is a vital national problem concentrated in a very small set of urban areas that have to be addressed by the whole country. You have a big part of the United States where accidental deaths are down, murder is way down, and you have a highly concentrated geography that's having a very different experience. And it is those two radically different experiences with firearms that inform much of the difficulty we have today talking about this really urgent and important problem that is critical for everyone in the country to get on board and try to solve. So, Senator, with that said, I'm going to stop there and see if maybe you want to move to questions.
Thank you so much.
Before we move on to the questions, this is a reminder, if you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guest this evening, press star 3 on your phone's keypad. That's star 3 if you have a question for the senator's guest this evening. And just as the senator indicated, we're interested in dialogue and discussion, and we're interested in civil dialogue and discussion. So if we're able to have that, that's fine. If not, we'll be forced to move to the next caller. And with that said, Senator, we can move to the first caller, and we're going to go to Belinda. Belinda, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood and guest.
Hello. Good afternoon. I'm sorry my voice is not good. I'm a little sick. But I was wanting to know, I know there's a lot of people think everybody wants to take their guns away, but I know that most of the country are for background checks. But what I'm thinking is, how come we can't implement that like state to state, just like they're doing with marijuana? You know, I know they have different laws in different states. I know in Jersey they have a no-carry gun law over there. But, you know, how come we can't do it state to state, implement, background checks for the guns?
Thank you very much, Linda, on your question regarding background checks. I know we do have some background checks in Pennsylvania already, but there's a desire to expand them. Johnson, go ahead.
Well, Senator, I have good news for Linda. We do, on a state-by-state basis, modify the way we do background checks. Let me explain. The federal government sets a floor, right? They set a minimum level of background checking that has to happen everywhere that U.S. law applies, including the Northern Mariana Islands and Puerto Rico and every U.S. state. When any person purchases a firearm, either a long gun or a handgun, so that's shotguns, rifles, and handguns, when they purchase such a firearm from a dealer, a federally licensed dealer, every time such a person makes such a purchase, a background check is required. Every single time. There are a handful of very small exceptions for police officers buying duty weapons that they'll use in their official capacity. But by and large, every gun, every time, background check. The question is what happens in the secondary market, right? So if I, as a private citizen, go to sell a gun to another private citizen not using a dealer, is a background check required? Pennsylvania law is more strict than federal law. Federal law doesn't require background checks for private sales. Pennsylvania law requires background checks for the private sale of handguns. Pennsylvania law does not require background checks for the private sale of long guns, and that is a balance in public policy that the General Assembly and Governor in Pennsylvania have struck.
I should say that there has been legislation to address having background checks for private sales of the long guns and the rifles. It comes up each time. I've been in the legislature for 4 years. It's come up for each of those 4 years, and it's a matter of discussion. May get passed in the future, but that's where we are today. And it is a matter of conversation and not something that is being ignored.
Belinda,
all right, who's our next caller?
Well, Belinda, thank you very much for your call. Just a reminder for those that have just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guest firearms attorney, Jonathan Goldstein, you can press star 3 on your phone's keypad. That's star 3 if you have a question tonight. Senator, we're going to move back to the callers. We're going to go to Todd. Todd, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Good evening. I'm Todd Sagan. I'm a family physician. I'm a past president of the Pennsylvania Academy of Family Physicians, and I'm well aware that gun injuries are a major public health concern, and I'm concerned that
Are you still there?
Gag rules that won't allow family physicians to discuss gun safety with their patients. I was wondering how he can justify that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole question. I know it was about gag rules, but I wasn't sure. I kind of lost the caller in the middle.
I guess the question is how you and the NRA can justify the advocating for gag rules that don't allow family physicians to counsel and discuss with their patients how to make sure that gun safety is occurring in their homes.
Senator, do you want me to just take the question?
Yeah, so I don't know that you have taken a position on gag rules. Maybe you have not. Of course, if you have not, that should be clarified.
Yeah, I mean, so I should be very clear. I'm here in my individual capacity today. I'm not here speaking on behalf of any organization. But my understanding is that the legislatures in certain states have decided that the issue of gun safety is not something that they want to allow physicians who are, you know, a regulated profession like doctors and accountants and others. It's something that they've taken off the table for them to discuss. And in other states, they haven't. And I hope that the legislature in Pennsylvania continues to vigorously look at just how they want to set the dial on this important topic.
And let me just say thank you again, Todd. We in Pennsylvania have not adopted a gag rule approach. Pretty much in favor of really fairly broad free speech on this matter, and generally speaking, have not tried to get involved with what the doctors say or do not say to their patients regarding violence or pretty much any other topic.
Todd, thank you very much for your question. Remember, if you have a question for Senator Haywood, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. If you have a question for Senator Haywood or Firearms Attorney Jonathan Goldstein, Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Satrice in Mount Airy. Satrice, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes. I would like to know, is it at all possible to either of you gentlemen, Attorney Goldstein or Senator Haywood, to do subliminal counseling on a wide scale on television and on radio about the dangers of gun and about committing crimes, period? What kind of person does this, about committing crimes, period? So that, you know, if this is done enough, it's certain to change something. I want to know if that's at all possible.
Thank you very much, Patrice. I do want to address that as a topic that's come up in my office. Coming up with a slogan or approach, you know, the approach of don't drink and drive was somewhat effective. Trying to encourage people not to be involved in violence, choose a path of opportunity. We've had two focus groups, actually, to come up with messages that will try to reach people who may have more likelihood to be in crime. And we went to a prison and heard from inmates about what kind of messages they thought would work. We had another focus group with young men and young women about what kind of messages might work. And so my office is actually in the current process of trying to identify messages that we think will reach people so they'll be discouraged from being involved in any kind of crime, whether it's gun-related crime or any other kind of crime.
Satrice, thank you very much for your question. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. And just a reminder, if you've just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood tonight, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go to Pete in Mount Airy. Pete, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes. I'd like to know, if somebody dies and leaves me some firearms, do you have to have them registered?
So, Senator, I can take that.
Yes. Thanks.
So, in Pennsylvania, we do not register firearms. In fact, actually, it's illegal by statute for the Pennsylvania State Police to create a registry of firearms. If you are left firearms by a will, there is no requirement that you receive a background check before taking those firearms. That is the case even in states with really restrictive laws like New Jersey. And the reason for that is that being willed firearms is not exactly a known vector for crime guns. No one says, here's my plan. We're going to wait for your dad to die. He's going to leave us some guns, and then we're going to go rob a liquor store. Generally speaking, it's not the way criminals acquire guns. It's not the way guns come into the flow of commerce to be used in crimes. And if you need further assistance, you can Google me. I'm at Goldstein Law Partners is my law firm, and we'd be happy to help you in any way we can to get those firearms straightened out in an estate context.
I should share, Pete, as well, that there is, on this matter as others, legislation to seek to create a firearms registry, but that has not passed at this time.
Pete, thank you very much for your call. Again, if you have a question for Senator Haywood, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go Riley in Glenside. Riley, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood. Riley, you there? Hello?
Hey, Riley.
Well, we seem to have lost Riley. We're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Phil. Phil, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi, this is Bill from Glenside. Am I on?
Yes. Go ahead,
okay,
Bill.
Man.
Yeah. So my question, I heard all these statistics about sort of the decrease in deaths from firearms, but my understanding is that a lot of that is because of the improvement in trauma care. I wonder how the statistics sound on actual shootings. There was a great article in the Inquirer this past Sunday on the tragic consequences of people who were shot and wounded and that will live the rest of their life paralyzed or otherwise limited. So I wonder if your guest has statistics on those issues.
Thank you, Bill, but before I have Jonathan speak, I just want to give you what I understood to be the context of what Jonathan shared at the beginning. What I understood Jonathan to be sharing with us at the beginning is that there's a lot of parts of the United States where there's not a lot of gun violence. And there are a few places in the United States where there is a lot of gun violence. And because we're dealing with Americans who in some areas have almost no gun violence, and in a few areas have a lot of gun violence, this is part of the challenge in reaching agreement about what to do or what not to do, because the experience of Americans with gun violence is so different. I believe that was the core point he was making in providing those statistics to us. Jonathan, you may have another take on it, but that's what I received from your comments.
No, Senator, you've captured it exactly, and I don't have any numbers with me right now on sort of the consequences of people who are shot and live. But what I can tell you is that, you know, guns are not necessarily, you know, the only thing we got to keep our eye on when we're talking about murder. So, for example, firearms are involved in 0.5%, that's half of 1% of accidental deaths nationally. Poisoning is 27%, so almost 50 times more vital as a vector for accidental death. Falls are 21%, and drowning is 3. So you're 6 times as likely to drown as you are to be accidentally shot. When you talk about murder itself, there were 11,961 murders in the U.S. in 2014. Of these, 1,567 were committed with knives, but only 248 were committed with rifles. Right? Feet, hands, and fists accounted for 660. So 3 times as many people were beaten to death as were shot with rifles. So, you know, you really have to look in a very layered way at where the death is coming from. I wish I had better numbers about the toll of people who are shot and live. Maybe for the next call we can look at that.
And I should add to something that Jonathan didn't mention is that the handguns is the largest source of the homicides, more so than, as he said, the rifles. I also want to share something that Jonathan said at the outset. He clearly acknowledged that gun violence is a serious problem in the United States of America. And that is the foundation from which we are working in this call. But I think his context, which is many Americans don't have the same experience that we do with high gun violence, is something we have to take into account as we move toward responding to gun violence. Thank
Senator,
you, Bill.
If I may add one other point on that, because I often get misunderstood on this. The fact that gun violence is happening in a narrow geography doesn't mean that we're not all on the hook for doing something about it, right? The people that live in the geographies where it's not happening are just as much on the hook as the people who are living in the geographies where it is happening. And one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing, even though I represent pro-gun groups and gun owners and all kinds of folks on that side of this argument all the time, is I try to help them understand, if you want to stop the calls for more gun control, we have got to do something about this. It's not enough to say, no murders in my county, good luck to the rest of you, right? This is a national problem of vital importance, and we're all obligated to try to do something about it.
Phil, thank you very much for your call. We're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Joy in Jenkintown. Joy, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi, Senator.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to be able to participate this evening. When I was in school and we learned about the Constitution and everything that is encompassed, the Second Amendment, it guarantees that it says that everybody has the right to bear arms. But when that was written, we all have to remember, which I think everybody forgets about, is the fact that when you bared arms in those days, it was an entirely different life. It was a different way of thinking. It was a different way of being able to provide for your family. And we didn't do a whole lot of statistics. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. However, at that juncture, when you did that, you had muskets and cannons. You didn't have the repeating rifles. You didn't have the Parkland shootings. You didn't have the kids. Anybody in the city of Philadelphia, and I'm saying Philadelphia because I grew up and was raised in Philadelphia, can go to any corner and purchase a gun. You're talking about there is really no gun control. And the people that are buying guns, anybody that wants a gun, a repeating one, or I forget what they're called. I'm not too knowledgeable. Please forgive me. But they have access to whatever they want as long as they have the money. And there's no background check required. I mean, how do we begin to control this? How
Thank
do
you,
we
Joy.
Say
yes.
Life is important?
Thank you so much, Joy. I'm glad you joined the call. That is a critical question that we're all concerned about. And access to legal guns is very different than access to illegal guns. And much of the challenge that I believe we have is how people can get access to guns illegally. Jonathan, you want to address that?
Sure. So, Joy touched on a bunch of different things. First of all, when the Constitution was written, there was no internet. When the Constitution was written, there were no automobiles. When the Constitution was written, there was no penicillin. So, lots of things have changed, but we found ways to adapt the Constitution and make it relevant for the modern life. Just because there was no internet when the Constitution was written doesn't mean that the First Amendment doesn't protect speech that occurs over the internet. There weren't a lot of Muslims living in the United States back then. In fact, the Founding Fathers referred to them as Muslim men or Muslim men. It was so uncommon for them to encounter them, and yet today we still afford, Islam and all of the other world religions protection under the First Amendment. So the Second Amendment, covers the kind of arms that are in common use, even though those arms didn't exist at the time of the Founding Fathers. With regard, very briefly, to the purchase of illegal guns, it is a felony under state and federal law to purchase guns illegally without a background check, handguns I'm talking about. It's a question of political will. It's a question of budget. And I think it's really incumbent upon, people from counties in the United States where they're not seeing this kind of violence to properly resource probation, parole, and enforcement resources, mental health resources, to make sure that the areas where this violence is happening are getting the help they need.
Joy, thank you very much for your call. We're going to go back to the callers. Before we do, though, for those that have just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guest, firearms attorney Jonathan Goldstein, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go to Karen. Karen, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood. Karen, are you there? Hello, Karen?
Oh, good.
Karen, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Good evening. I have a question, please. I agree
sure.
with what Joy had said. I do believe in the statistics that you're talking about, but you all have to get together and fix the loopholes in Pennsylvania, the gun shows, And anybody can get a gun in Philadelphia. Joy's right. You can go to any corner and get a gun. You can also stand at any corner and be shot. And it's wrong. There's advertisements all over in Philadelphia about these gun shows. There are so many loopholes. The wrong people are getting guns without the proper screening. And not only that, it's terrible how they're able to get the automatic rifles, and the killings, the murders keep going up. I don't care about your statistics. I sit here night after night, and there has never, ever been a night that passed where there wasn't news of a shooting in Philadelphia. And that's including children that were hit accidentally, children that are sleeping in their beds and get killed. It's totally out of control. And I really don't think the NRA want to do anything about it.
So let me just thank you, Ken, for raising obviously critical issues when people are getting shot, some surviving, some not surviving. And, of course, you're right. It happens on a daily basis in Philadelphia and Chicago and many other cities across the United States. It seems to me, though, you've got two possibly separate questions there, Jonathan.
Sure.
One was respect to what happens at the gun shows.
Yep.
And the second one seemed to be related possibly to the demand by many for an assault weapon ban.
Sure. So let me say something, too. You know, when you watch the news, you're not getting a full picture of what's going on in the world necessarily, right? We have data from the CDC that show that in 2015 – the total number and rate of unintentional firearms deaths among those ages 0 to 14 were tied for the lowest observed since 1981. The odds of a child being injured by a firearm are less than 1 in a million in the United States. It's very, very, very low. So, you know, don't let the sensationalism of a news story here or there, you know, dissuade you from understanding that the child death from firearms accidents is very, very low. With regard to gun shows, there is no gun show loophole. What you hear described as the gun show loophole is merely the fact that in Pennsylvania, private sales of long guns do not require background checks. Well, why is that? Well, because when we've gone into the courts, excuse me, into the jails, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is a federal agency, part of the DOJ, went into prisons and they interviewed prisoners. They did this in November of 2001. And they said to these inmates, where did you get the guns? Of the inmates who carried a firearm during their offenses, 8 in 10 carried a handgun. Well, when they asked them where they got the guns, 78.8% of those people, of those offenders, people in jail for committing a gun crime, said they got the gun from a friend, family, or street illegal source, meaning it was a straw purchase. Only 1.2% of those incarcerated gun criminals said they got the gun from a gun show or a flea market. So what this tells us is that gun shows are, in fact, not a vector for crime guns. They just aren't. If you buy a handgun at a gun show, whether you buy it from a private seller or a dealer that's licensed at the gun show, you're going to have a background check. And it's really important to keep an eye on that. Third question was about assault weapons bans, and this is probably the cutting edge in firearms regulation. There are some circuit courts of appeals in the United States that have held that firearms that you would call an assault weapon, that I would just simply call a high-capacity rifle, are legal for citizens to own, and some have said that legislatures can ban them. It's working its way to the Supreme Court, and we'll probably find out in the next year or so where the line should be drawn.
Karen, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Jennifer. Jennifer, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi, this is Jennifer Luger in Jenkintown.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate both of you spending time with us this evening. I want to discuss, we talked a lot about homicide and accidental deaths. I want to talk a little bit about the two-thirds of gun deaths in this country every day that are gun suicides. One of those was my husband, and nobody can tell me that that is not gun violence. So red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders have been passed. I believe the number is 13 states now with bipartisan support that allow families and law enforcement, families or law enforcement to petition a court to have guns temporarily removed from a person in crisis. I believe strongly that we need such legislation in Pennsylvania. I believe it may have saved my husband's life, and I appreciate Senator Haywood's leadership. I just wanted to get your take on red flag laws or ERPO laws.
So I want to begin by saying I'm so sorry that that happened to your husband and to you. That's devastating and tragic, and I'm terribly sorry. Gun violence restraining orders or emergency or extreme risk protection orders are something that are being passed in some states. We did look at it here in Pennsylvania. I personally worked on a bill to try to make that happen. The difficult challenge with those bills is that people's right to due process has to also be protected. You can't have somebody say, I think that guy's at risk, and immediately the guns disappear without a hearing, without an opportunity for notice and to be heard. And so getting that dial set correctly has been the biggest challenge. We took a run at it in this last session, and we may very well take a run at it again in the next session. But, again, so sorry for what happened to you and to your husband.
And there's legislation to end for the next session beginning January of 19 to take another shot at it to see if we can get it right so we do follow the other states that Jennifer mentioned. Before we take the next caller, though, if I could take an opportunity to ask Jonathan to share his role in some recent legislation that we passed, which was to require individuals who have a protection from abuse order against them to turn their guns over to law enforcement. And Jonathan, could you share with people who may not be aware of what this law requires, and as well as your role in it? I think that would be helpful.
Senator, you're very kind to suggest that I had a role in it, and I did. It was HB 2060, which was the bill that we just passed in the last session, and what this did was change some of the ground rules around protection from abuse orders and firearms. So protection from abuse sits at the intersection of both state and federal law. Federal law requires people who are subject to protection from abuse orders to turn in their guns. They're unable to own guns. They're unable to purchase guns. They're unable to possess guns. State law did not conform to federal law. Now, that didn't mean that people weren't required to obey federal law. What the legislature wanted to do in this last session was make it clear that Pennsylvania law conformed to federal law and also required the turning in of guns. But we also did a couple of other very important things. We changed the way that protection from abuse orders got served, right? The way that they used to get served all across the state, and this was insane, was we used to have the people who were subject to the order serve them on the abuser. Well, now the police or the sheriff are required to serve those, and that was a very important change. The goal here is to lower the temperature, and having an abuse victim make service of a protection from abuse order on her abuser was not the way to do it. We also put some important due process protections in place. PFA orders now come into effect when they are served, not when they are issued. There were certain courts in Pennsylvania that said they came into effect the minute they were signed, notwithstanding the fact that the people who were subject to them didn't necessarily know that they were in existence yet. Those were court orders that had been signed but not yet sent out with a sheriff and served. We changed that. We also changed it so that a person who is subject to a protection from abuse order gets notice of their right to present witnesses, of the right to compel the attendance of witnesses, and the method by which they can compel those witnesses. So the goal was to sort of make this even. A PFA happens very quickly. Somebody who's subject to it now has the ability to bring witnesses to say, hey, look, I'm not abusing my spouse, and here's some people who can say I didn't. And then we made a couple of other changes in the context of that. We put in place some language for abandoned firearms. Sheriffs and district attorneys and coroners all over the state were telling us, you know, we've got rooms full of these abandoned firearms. We put some language in place to bring order to the way those get disposed of. And finally, we did something to lower the burden on the judiciary of handling PFAs, and that is that if a person agrees to have a PFA entered against them by consent, they have the opportunity to go back if they behave properly after 10 years and have those PFAs expunged. So on balance, a pretty good bill. We're very grateful for the senator for his support of it. It passed unanimously through the Senate and went over to the House, where we got it done there as well, and the governor signed it.
Jonathan, thank you very much for that explanation. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. If you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guest this evening, firearms attorney Jonathan Goldstein, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. We're going to go to John in Philadelphia. John, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, my thing is about private transactions with guns. How do you enforce having a private transaction have a background check?
Senator, you want me to take it?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, great. So the way it works is that if you have a handgun, you're obligated to go to a dealer to transfer that handgun, and a failure to do so is a criminal act, and that's pretty well how it's enforced. So if we find you in possession of a handgun and you've committed a crime and we say, where'd you get it, and you don't have an answer that comports with the requirement that that handgun need to be transferred through a dealer, you'll be charged criminally.
Anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. And one of the challenges that is coming as part of the challenge is how we can get any kind of enforcement in that kind of transaction where obviously the police or no one else will know. And, in fact, we won't have any recognition that the sale actually happened until possibly ends up at a crime scene. So this is part of the challenge in how we manage the transaction that John just mentioned. There is another set of approaches, though, that I don't know if people on the call are familiar with, which is how we try to successfully or unsuccessfully manage something called straw purchases. Jonathan, could you describe how a straw purchase works and the laws around straw purchases?
Sure. So a straw purchase is where a person with a clean record, clean criminal record, goes in and uses that clean criminal record to acquire a firearm from the lawful dealer network where firearms, you know, come into the stream of commerce, and then gives that firearm or sells that firearm to a person whose record is not clean. I actually wrote an article about straw purchases in Philadelphia. Let me tell you a little bit about it. In March 2008, Mark Fazzola, who was an Inquirer reporter at the time, wrote an article called PA, a Favored Source for Gun Traffickers. And he lamented in that article that most of the state's 67 county prosecutors didn't file any cases against straw buyers in 2006 or 7. So what I did is I went back to the data for the year before his article. I went back to 2004, and I compared 2004 to the then most current year available, which was 2011. Before Fazzola wrote his article, there were 84 total prosecutions for straw purchases in the 67 counties across our Commonwealth, an average of 1.25 per county. In 2011, there were only 136. It went up to 2 per county. So straw purchases are already a felony in Pennsylvania and under state law and under federal law. And we really weren't putting enough resources towards it. I have long advocated, and I'm sure the senator would also advocate, properly resourcing task force to go after that 78.8% of gun criminals who say they got their guns from a street or illegal source. Now, I will say one last thing about it. I was on a panel a number of years ago with Sylvester Johnson. He was the police commissioner. And I called on him. I said, you ought to be doing more about this. This is an evil thing that's going on with these straw purchases. And his answer to me was, well, they're very hard to prosecute. And I said to him, well, you know, murder is also hard to prosecute. But it's a social evil. We've decided to stamp it out, and it's been properly resourced, and we go after the murderers. And we need to go after the straw purchasers, too.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Lurline. Lurline, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi, good evening. You just answered my part of my question. But straw purchases are big business. And I'm wondering if I get paid, folks are being paid to purchase guns,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lucrative business. I want to know, how many guns can one person buy? And how do you keep a track of how many purchases that are made?
We do keep track. And if a person goes into a dealer and purchases multiple handguns, either in a single day or over a period of days, a notice is sent to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the federal agency that regulates gun dealers. And a person who frequently or repeatedly buys multiple firearms will come onto their radar screen. So we have a pretty good infrastructure for picking up people who are doing it. The question is, do we have the funding and the political will? And here again, I call on the elected representatives from other parts of the state where they don't see a lot of gun violence to properly fund enough detectives and probation and parole and judges and if necessary, jail space to properly handle all of the straw sellers and straw purchasers that are out there doing this.
I should also say we do have legislation that would limit the purchase of guns to one per month. That would automatically reduce the capacity of a person, legal or straw purchaser, to acquire and transfer guns. That has not passed. It has passed in a few other states, but that is a matter for the legislation, the legislature. We're doing good. We got a lot of calls in here. Thanks, Johnson. Let's keep going.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Senator. We're going to go to Bill in Mount Airy. Bill, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi. I have a question. If a person in Philadelphia was convicted of a nonviolent white-collar crime, a felony, but white-collar, let's say he wrote a check, and does that mean that he can't own a firearm because it's nonviolent? And you know, I can understand a violent person who's shooting everybody, you know, they can't own a firearm, but is the same hold true for a nonviolent white collar thing? And what's the remedy, if there is one, forever?
So there are a certain narrow range of white collar crimes that, even though they are felonies under federal law, do not become disabling, though they may become disabling under state law. The intersection of firearms disabilities, that is to say, the thing that makes you not able to buy a gun, between state and federal law is one of the things that makes my phone ring the most. But I'll give you an example of a client that came into my office. He was a young man who had sold some CDs on SEPTA, and it was a first-degree misdemeanor. He was picked up and arrested. It was a copyright violation. And we put the question to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives and the state police together, and they determined that it's not a prohibitor under federal law, not a prohibitor under state law, and this young man was able to purchase a firearm to protect himself personally. So very, very complicated question at the interplay of two distinct sets of laws, and I'd be happy if you Google me at Goldstein Law Partners, Jonathan Goldstein, to take a question that deals with your particulars if I can assist you in any way.
Good. Hey, before we do another question, I had a it looks like I've covered protection from abuse orders. I've covered straw purchases. Let me ask Jonathan about safe storage. So there are some areas of the country where there's a belief that there should be some regulations to see that guns are put in some kind of safe storage arrangement so that the chances of what you describe, the accidental shootings, are down. What's the status or the effectiveness of those kind of laws as far as you are aware?
So the effectiveness varies. And, you know, in the states where they haven't enacted safe storage laws, it's because they recognize that people live in a variety of different circumstances. You know, when I was childless and single and lived in a particular place, keeping a gun in my nightstand might have been an appropriate way for it to be stored. I never had anybody in my house but me, that sort of thing. You know, in my current configuration, where I have children in and out of my house a lot, you know, it's incumbent upon me to store my firearms in a little bit of a safer way. You know, I happen to be of the political view that, you know, people ought to be responsible for their own lives, and people ought to make an effort, every gun owner ought to make an effort to responsibly store his firearms in a way that works for you know, for his life. I will also say that safe storage laws don't take into account the fact that you have plenty of people with physical disabilities. I mean, imagine a wheelchair-bound person or a person with Parkinson's, you know, who has to lock his or her gun away, but maybe lives in a violent neighborhood where quick access to that gun is required. So it's not quite as simple an issue as just requiring everybody to lock it up and then and moving on our merry way.
Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Linda in Germantown. Linda, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, I don't. I want to know, how do you buy a gun? Average Joe Blow like myself go into a gun shop and want to purchase a gun. So what happens? Walk me through that.
Sure. So there is no more heavily regulated consumer product in the United States than a firearm. Not OxyContin, not vehicles, nothing. There's nothing you buy with more that has more regulation than a gun. And yet, it happens fairly quickly. How? You go into the store and you identify the firearm you want to buy, and then, as is the case with every gun sold by a dealer anywhere in the United States, a background check is conducted. You fill out a form, a federal form and a state form. The federal form is called a 4473. It's a reference to the form number that the ATF prints on the form. On that form, we ask you for your name, your place of birth, your eye color, your weight, your height, your race, your address. We ask you to answer a bunch of questions about your background, and then we ask you to produce photo ID that matches all of that. If all the questions are in order and the photo ID matches what's on the form, the dealer will call a hotline that is staffed by the Pennsylvania State Police from 6 in the morning to 10 at night, 365 days a year. They will call that hotline, read them your demographic information, and the state police will conduct a nationwide background check. If you committed a crime in Saipan, or you committed a crime in Georgia or Pennsylvania, it'll get picked up and put in that database. If a PFA is entered against you in Louisiana, within 24 hours it'll be in that database. And the state police will then respond to the request for a background check with one of three answers. Yes, proceed with the sale, deliver the gun. No, purchase denied, do not deliver the gun. Or wait, further research required. And the further research required typically happens when you have a very common name and we need to make sure that you're the actual John Smith who's got a clean record, not the John Smith who has a dirty record. And then we deliver that gun to you. That's how it works.
I should share that the in conversations with the state police, they have a good system of background checks, I believe, here in Pennsylvania, because we have some state records and some federal records. So that puts us in a strong position. And there are there's a significant number of purchases that are denied each year because the individual does not pass the background check. And so Pennsylvania is fortunate to have the state system and the national system, and I talked to the state police. There are hundreds, maybe actually more than hundreds of sales that they have stopped because the individual has not passed the background check.
Senator, I happen to have the numbers with me.
Go ahead.
The number of PICS checks in the first 3 months of 2018 was up slightly over 2017. So there were 290,000 PICS checks in 17 and 297,000 in 17, excuse me, in 18, so up about 7,000. But 110 fewer people were denied in 18. There were 3,269 people denied in the first quarter of this year.
That's 3 months only.
3 months only, and 1,379 of those people were referred to law enforcement agencies following the background check, meaning their denial was serious enough that we thought law enforcement should get involved.
Linda, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Edward. Edward, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hello, Senator. Thank you for taking my call. My question actually changed from the time that I was on hold, so I'll try to keep it brief. In regard to the store purchases, since the conversation went that way, you made a point saying that initially these were done by people who had clean records, who purchased these weapons and then either gave or sold these weapons to people who were criminals. Is that correct?
That's what a straw purchase
yes.
is, yes. Yeah.
Okay. I have to say that I disagree with that. I would think that people with clean records would want to stay clean and not be associated with straw purchases, and that criminals are probably transferring weapons between criminals and not people who are not criminals. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. What do you have to justify that?
So the definition I use is the standard law enforcement definition, but let me tell you how we see it manifested often. You'll have a woman typically who's in perhaps an abusive relationship. Maybe there's a power dynamic at work where she's downwind of forces that are beyond her control. And again, here I'm painting with a very broad brush. But you'll see that woman often with a clean record compelled by force or compelled by other circumstances to go in and use her clean record to acquire a firearm for a boyfriend or lover or husband or other associate who maybe doesn't have a clean record. Similarly, you'll see, you know, a young person, somebody who's just 21 but wants to, you know, get in good with a group that maybe is in his neighborhood or somewhere else. He'll use his clean record to buy a gun for somebody, you know, who just came out of prison or who doesn't have a clean record. So it's a really awful set of circumstances that a lot of these people find themselves in. It's certainly not to minimize at all the fact that criminals sell guns to other criminals. But the classic straw purchase is clean record buyer selling gun, giving gun to dirty record purchaser.
And, Bill, I just do want to share that there are this is Edward. There are videos of individuals with clean record buying up guns, going out to the parking lot, and turning them over to folks who otherwise couldn't acquire them. Obviously, that's why they're in the parking lot. So it is a practice that is a problem, and one we need to clamp down on so we can, in part, not fully, in part, cut the, or reduce the supply of guns to folks who are criminals and who don't have a legal right to get the guns in the first place.
Well, Edward, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Cecilia in Mount Airy. Cecilia, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes. People who are obviously mentally ill and who already are gun owners, what rights do they have? How do we take away their guns, their weapons, their dangers to themselves and others?
So the way it works in Pennsylvania is we have three levels of examination that people who are potentially a risk to themselves and others encounter when they come into contact with the mental health system. The first level is what's called a 302, which stands for Section 7302 of the Mental Health Procedures Act. This is when the police are summoned to a location, a family member calls and says, I have a relative in distress. A person is taken to a mental health facility, there's one in every county designated for these examinations, and he encounters a physician within 2 hours of his arrival there. When encountering the physician, the physician assesses whether the person is a risk to himself or others and has committed an act in furtherance of that risk, right? So it's not enough to say, I'm sad. You have to say, I'm sad and I took a bottle of pills, or, you know, I'm suicidal and I went and loaded a handgun and put it in my lap. So it has to be the utterance and the act in furtherance. If there is such a circumstance, the physician, on the signature of the physician alone, keeps that person for observation for up to 5 days. Under current Pennsylvania law, that, by the state police, is considered to be an adjudication of mental illness, and the person is stripped of firearms rights for the rest of his life. I have a suit pending in federal court today where I've challenged that practice on the part of the state police, because critically absent from that process, the 302 process, is any semblance of due process. Right, you have no opportunity to consult a lawyer. You have no opportunity for a written record, a neutral arbiter, compelling witnesses, presenting evidence before your constitutional rights are stripped forever. Now, if after the 5 days you're kept, the state police conduct a hearing under Section 303, 304, or 305, all of which have substantially increased due process protections, where you get a lawyer, you get a neutral, you have a right to go to a judge, and people who've been subject to 303s, 304s, and 305s are considered permanently disabled from acquiring or possessing firearms. That's the infrastructure today in Pennsylvania.
I should share, Cecilia, that one of the callers earlier, Jennifer, talked about a new process which is called Extreme Risk Protection Order, This is something we have discussed in Harrisburg, actually had legislation that was under significant discussion in Harrisburg, so that there could be a process for individuals who are seen as an extreme immediate risk, who have mental illness, to have their guns confiscated. That has not yet passed. It's not the law in Pennsylvania today, but it is very much under discussion in Harrisburg.
Sylvia, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Ernestine. Ernestine, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi. I'm Senator Haywood and guest. I have a question. Is it legal to buy a gun in another state and you live in a say I'm living in Pennsylvania and I went to South Carolina and I bought a gun and brought it back. Would that be a gun that I could use, or is that something I need to buy in-state?
So it's a very complicated question at the intersection of both federal law and the law of two separate states. Broadly speaking, to buy a handgun from a dealer, you have to buy that handgun in your state of residence. Long guns can be purchased in other states. As long as it's okay under both states' laws, it's okay under federal law. If your circumstances are such that you want to chase this really to ground, Google me, Jonathan Goldstein at Goldstein Law Partners. My office is in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, and I would be delighted to help you by taking your call.
Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Barbara. Barbara, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, good evening. My
good evening.
Question is, how do we resolve the issue that so many young people in urban areas have with gun violence? Somehow or another, they think that they can resolve their issues by shooting at each other, not understanding the consequences, which could be at age 18, you spend the rest of your life in jail, and or if you're the victim, you could end up dead or disabled. Do we need to have some seminars in the schools? You have to reach them at an early age and impress upon them the danger of what they are doing to resolve issues. Because every day on the local news, you hear about some gun violence, and many times it's among young people who see that as a way to resolve an issue.
I strongly agree, Barbara, that we need to look at getting into the heads, the minds of young people so that they can see that they can resolve conflict nonviolently. And there are some cities in the United States which have a school curriculum focused on nonviolent conflict resolution. In Boston, they've begun a curriculum, I think it's also, as you say, in middle school, to begin to inculcate young people with nonviolent conflict resolution. That is something that I think we need to bring into Philadelphia so that individuals see a way out. We've had a number of conversations with young people to try to help them see that there's a way out. But getting it into the school system is a way to reach more than the 10 or 20 young people that I can reach. It's a way to reach thousands, tens of thousands of young people to begin this message of nonviolent conflict resolution. It is part of the solution. And I just want to share that there are many aspects to violence as well as gun violence. We've only talked about one small set, although there are many pieces to getting our communities to a point of peace. But Barbara, I think that is one of them, as well as this discussion about access to guns.
Senator, I think you've hit on a very important point here, and I think, you know, now that we're closing in on the 8 o'clock hour, I'm delighted to actually have this be one of the last things we talk about. There was a wonderful study done in Wilmington, Delaware, in 2015. They released a report after it. It was called Elevated Rates of Urban Firearm Violence and Opportunities for Prevention, Wilmington, Delaware. If you Google it, you'll find it. And what they did is they had a dramatic increase in shootings among young people in Wilmington, Delaware. And the Wilmington City Council passed a resolution and begged the Centers for Disease Control to come in and say, what is going on? Why is this happening? And this report is one of the best, most succinct reports that I've seen generated that says, here is what we do, here is how we intervene, here are the factors that contribute. 80-some-odd% of the people that committed gun violence, young people that committed gun violence, were unemployed in the month prior to committing that gun violence. We know about their truancy from school. We know about their victimhood. You know, many of them were crime victims. They'd been stabbed or shot themselves in the weeks leading up to it. So we have all of these really, really important indicators that we can track for young people as they move down the road towards an act of violence. And I would encourage anyone in public policy who wants to know how to stop this to look at this Wilmington report. It's very important.
Barbara, thank you very much for your call. Jonathan, thank you very much for that additional information. Senator, we're coming down the home stretch. I know you have some concluding remarks for those that have joined us.
I do. And I just want to thank the large number of people who were able to get on and raise a significant question. That included Belinda and Todd and Patrice, Pete, Jennifer, John, Bill, Linda, Bill, Edmund, Cecilia, Ernestine, Joy, Karen, Leeline, I mean, so many. I just can't thank you enough for joining this call. Especially, I do have a special thanks to Jonathan. He has led us in participating in a great discussion. And for all of you who have an additional question that didn't get answered, please call my office at 215-242-8171. Or you can leave a question at my website, SenatorHaywood.com. Again, Jonathan, thank you so much. Callers, thank you so much. This is part of a bigger process that we are all engaged to improve our communities. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Senator.
Just as a reminder, if you didn't have a chance to ask your question, and you still remain in the line, please remain there. You'll be able to leave your question on a voicemail for Senator Haywood, and he and his staff will get back to you. I want to thank everybody who participated this evening in Senator Art Haywood's telephone town hall. You have been a great audience, and have a good evening.